as have been in your homes and such, about some of the terrible things that happen in our society that we don't like to think about, but we realize goes on. Some of you have mentioned problems with drug and alcohol abuse, or with some of the things that people do to other people, and the abuse and the injury and the things that we would just rather think didn't happen. I can't say that there's one thing I can talk about that's going to solve all of those things, but there is something I can talk about that will relate to almost all of those problems that we recognize around us, especially in how people treat themselves and treat other people. And that's the topic of self-esteem. The attitude that we have toward ourselves often has a tremendous amount to do with the way we conduct ourselves and relate to other people. The problem of poor self-esteem, I think, is a much more widespread one than we often have thought about or taken the time to consider. It is very probable that it affects the majority of the people who are in this building right now, either personally or through the fact that it has impact in someone very close to us. At the very best, the problem of poor self-esteem will render us as less effective servants of God. That's the best scenario. At its worst, it leads to some very dangerous and destructive behavior toward ourselves, toward other people, and toward God and His work. There are a lot of ideas that people have in our society of how to deal with the problem. Many of them are superficial. Many of them are based simply on human ideas of psychology that really do not get down to the root problems and deal with them from the only real perspective that we can. Just like every other problem that faces man, the answers to this one are in the Bible. And we've got to open the Bible and take those answers and be able to apply them and use them in our lives. As Christians, above anybody else in this world, we ought to be able to deal with the topic of self-esteem and be able to recognize how it relates in our own lives. When we deal with that idea, we're going to be considering it from the standpoint of what are we worth? If you will, if you can imagine some of those scenes, another one of those things we don't like to think about, not so uncommon 150 years ago throughout many parts of this country, where slaves were put on an auction block and sold. And you've maybe seen movies and such that depicted that concept on television. And in seeing that, there's the idea of somebody being brought up and put on an auction block and a group of people around examining that person and trying to decide his or her value and bidding on the basis of that. Somebody who's big and strong and obviously could do a lot of work might bring three times what a little scrawny guy like me would bring, because his worth is judged by somebody else to be greater. When we deal with the idea of self-esteem, in a sense, we've got to think of ourselves not on a slave auction block, but in a situation where our value is being judged. To realize that a poor self-esteem is a widespread problem with a lot of wrong answers, and that we've got to realize that the only one who can really appraise our value is God Himself. And that's the approach that we're going to be taking this morning. To first recognize that this is a problem that does affect us. And it's not something we can just set aside as a victimless crime. When we talk about the problem of self-esteem, it's easy for somebody to say, well, so what if I don't like myself? That doesn't hurt anybody else. I don't know that there could be anything that's truly further from the truth. On the surface, poor self-esteem may appear to just have that one victim, the person himself. But when we carry it and we really consider it, we realize that a person that doesn't like himself damages other people, and it affects a number of relationships. If you will turn with me to Mark chapter 12. After some of the things I've just said, I want to make sure that this is approached from a biblical perspective, because I can get up here and provide psychology and not do any more good than somebody else does. We need to look at it from what the Scriptures have to say. And there's a statement in Mark 12 that I want us to think about the implications of it in this area. Beginning of verse 29, Jesus answered him, "The first of all commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength.' This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." All of us have heard that passage read time and time again and recognized the two basic commandments that are given there and how important they are. But now consider the implications of that second one for a person who does not love himself. How are we going to love our neighbor? If we have not learned how to see our own position and value in this world, how are we going to relate properly to others? And so it's a problem that has a lot of victims. One of the major victims of a poor self-esteem is one's family. It's carried out in so many different ways. Just consider another passage in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 33. Just looking at the surface implications of these passages at the moment, we're going to talk about the practical consequences again too. But it says in verse 33 of Ephesians 5, "Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." A husband who can't deal with himself and is constantly down on himself is not going to treat his wife very well. And it's an obvious consequence that in a practical sense all of us have seen. Love and a genuine concern ought to radiate from a husband to the wife to the children and throughout the family. That's part of my responsibility as a husband and father. But if I don't recognize my value and where I fit into my family, my wife suffers. My children suffer. And that's where the consequences of a poor self-esteem spread, and in some cases, in very ugly ways. As many of you are aware, my wife and I are involved in keeping a couple of foster children, one of whom was abused rather severely at the age of 6.5 months. That abuse and neglect that is so common in our society and that happens a whole lot more frequently than we'd like to think in towns the size of Peyton City is often rooted in a poor self-esteem and somebody who has not understood where he relates to the world. It's a problem that we've got to recognize and that, whether we want to admit it or not, many of us have to deal with in our own lives. And we've got to be able to take a biblical approach and understand where we fit in and where we have a role in God's plans for us. But there are other people as well who suffer from the problem of self-esteem, carrying it outside the family. Those that we relate to on a day-to-day basis will suffer if we do not have a grip on who we are and where we belong in this life. Again, consider that principle we noticed in Mark 12:31. Love your neighbor as yourself. If we don't love ourselves, something is going to go wrong. And in application, think about how it applies. How many times do we know people who try to build themselves up by tearing other people down? Isn't it really a problem that we haven't understood our own value and don't have the confidence to stand on the basis of where we are in God's eyes, and therefore we want to try to tear somebody else down? Sometimes there are people who act almost like caged animals, as if they've been backed up into a corner and they've got to scratch and claw to get out and tear down anybody that's in the way, as if they are trapped by what's going on around them. And we need to be careful, as that relates often in church problems. Many churches have been splintered by problems that have been rooted in a misunderstanding of where we belong in God's eyes and a poor self-esteem. And there's several symptoms. They manifest themselves in different ways in different people. I'll just toss out a couple of examples you can think about. Somebody who is preoccupied with self-justification, having to constantly justify his existence before others, is generally showing symptoms of suffering from a problem of self-esteem. Now, it comes out in a lot of different ways. For some people, it's by bragging constantly. And we see somebody who brags a lot, and we think, boy, that person's arrogant and thinks he's way up here. I just about bet that 99.9% of the time, it's somebody who's down here in his self-esteem. And what he's trying to do is draw attention to himself so that others will build him up and he can feel better about himself. What we think of as being one extreme problem may actually be rooted in the opposite extreme. It's also in other cases brought out by one who seeks attention for himself, maybe by seeking self-pity, by putting himself down constantly to where others are drawn to sympathize. It's a person who is needing some reinforcement in many cases. Some do it by feeling a need to constantly defend and justify everything that they do, a paranoia that everybody's looking to find fault and therefore they've got to constantly be justifying and defending themselves. Others bring it out in the form of criticism or belittling of others. The idea, if I can make them look smaller, somehow I look bigger. Well, you know, I live not too far from Lake Huron, about 6 or 8 miles as the bird flies. It takes us 20 minutes or so to get there. But if two people are out in that water and one pushes the other one down, that doesn't exactly make him any further up out of the water. And we've got to realize that by belittling somebody else doesn't make us a bit bigger, a bit taller. But sometimes it's a manifestation of that problem of not seeing where we fit. Sometimes it's through assuming evil motives for everything that somebody else does. They're out to get me, or they're doing it because. Well, do we know? Sometimes people do things that seem foolish to us, but with the best of intentions. Jesus even was able to ascribe to the people who were killing him the best of intentions. And we need to be careful when we start judging the motives of others without really having a basis for drawing those conclusions. What we've got to consider is that while many people might appear to be self-centered, the problem is that they really don't have themselves in a proper perspective. And in the local congregation, it can be all kinds of trouble. We've got to watch out for the problems that result from that. Another victim of a poor self-esteem, one that we might very easily overlook in all this discussion, and that's self. I didn't put that at the top of the list, nor did I put it at the bottom, although the one that's at the bottom is not the least important by any means. But we need to recognize that self is often one of the very obvious victims of self-esteem. It has its immediate cost in the misery that people go through on a day-to-day basis, living pessimistic, negative lives. Sometimes it brings itself out in other ways as people look for some way to escape the problems or to try to make the problems look smaller. And that's where I mentioned that it is a root in many cases of the problems we see of drug abuse, whether it's legal drugs such as alcohol or illegal ones, that it often is that problem of somebody who does not feel satisfied with where he is and is either trying to gain status among his peers by doing what they're doing, or is trying to escape the problems by seeking something that will alter the condition of the mind and help us to get away from it all. The sad reality is that when the person wakes up, when the person comes out of the high or the low that's induced by that drug, the problems are still there. And in many cases, it starts a vicious cycle of repetition that may take a lifetime of struggling with it. If we could just get to the root of the problem early in many of these cases, it could be avoided. And that's where we've got to look at an understanding of where we fit into this world. But more significant even the long or the short-term cost. What goes on in this life is the long-term cost. There's a statement over Mark chapter 8 I want to look at in just a moment. And as you're turning over there, I want you to think about something that all of us have heard about. And that is that people sometimes will sell something that is of tremendous value because they don't recognize its value. I heard one time about somebody at a garage sale who bought some little piece of glass for $10. Some, I don't know exactly what it was, a candle holder or a glass or whatever. Took it somewhere else where that particular type of glass was known and sold it for $10,000 a couple of weeks later. The person who sold it in the garage sale probably felt sick for a few weeks. They had sold something of great value because they didn't realize its value. In Mark chapter 8, there's a comment to this effect. Verse 36, he says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" The answer to that question for too many people in our society is peanuts. That people will sell their souls for very, very little because they don't esteem the value of what they've got. They don't recognize that this thing that they thought was worth $10 is worth a whole lot more than $10,000, and consequently sell it at a very low price. Many of us have pondered at times and just with difficulty understanding, as we see things depicted for us in the news and on television, how someone could sell themselves into a life of prostitution. It's a fact that they don't recognize the value of their person. And they're selling themselves for a tremendously low price. Well, we can think of that when we're talking about somebody else in a particular sin or crime. But we need to recognize that in many ways it happens as well in the lives of common everyday people like you and me. There are many people who enter marriages mistakenly because of a low self-esteem, who may stay in even an illicit relationship, taking abuse from somebody they're not even married to, but stay in an illicit relationship because of a low self-worth, and that somehow they feel that they've got a dependence there that they just can't let go of. They don't recognize their own value. Self is often a very serious victim of a poor self-esteem. And I said the one at the bottom of the list is not the least important of these. God suffers from the poor self-esteem of people like you and me. In this life, when we think we are worthless, we rob him of our potential to serve him effectively. We think of ourselves as incapable of accomplishing great things, and therefore we don't accomplish great things because we don't try to accomplish great things because we know we fail anyway. And we get into that cycle of thinking where we belittle ourselves in our own minds, and we're much like the Israelites who looked at those people in Canaan and were like grasshoppers in their own sight, and therefore didn't go and conquer the land. And God had to wait till he brought up a whole new generation to do the job that they could have done if they had recognized where they were in God's eyes. The same is true when we think of it in carrying it to its eternal consequences. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 has a statement that it really ought to cause us to think about the way we view ourselves. It says in verse 20 there, "For you were bought at a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." A poor self-esteem robs God of something that he paid a tremendous price to buy. He paid the price of his son dying on the cross to buy you. And if we allow a poor self-esteem to make us ineffective, useless in his kingdom, and to eventually lose our souls over it, we have robbed him of the most precious thing in this world to him. God is a victim of the problem of poor self-esteem. Well, that's one thing to talk about a problem. Any of us can get up here and talk about a problem. What about a solution, though? What is it that will help us to deal with the problem of poor self-esteem? We've got to go back to that illustration I used a moment ago of buying a piece of glass at a garage sale or any other item. I know absolutely nothing about art. I can look at a picture and decide whether it looks good to me, and that's as far as I can get. And I can look at some of them that are supposed to be tremendously valuable, and it appears to me to be junk that doesn't make a bit of sense. I don't know anything about it to be able to look at a piece and say, this one is worth 10 cents, and that one is worth $500,000. Some people claim to be able to make that distinction. And so if somebody were buying a piece of art, they would probably want to bring in some sort of an appraiser to evaluate that. And in a practical sense, I don't know if we've got anybody in this group that collects valuable art pieces at $500,000 or whatever. I'd be a little surprised, but I guess it could happen. But in other areas that we deal with more commonly, if you go out to buy a car, you go out to buy a house, in some way you're going to have an appraisal involved. If it's a car, you might want to look at some magazines and read what they say about this one or that one and decide which one's the better value for your money. If it's a house, before a bank will ever loan you the money, they are going to send an expert to that house, at least one, who's going to go through it and look in every little nook and cranny and write some notes down on a piece of paper and say, this house is worth this much money. And the bank will then lend you a certain percentage of that. They will appraise the value. They're not going to accept it for me to walk into a bank and say, well, I just looked at this house over here and I think it's worth $35,000. I'd like a loan. They'll laugh in my face. And they'll say, it'll take us 3 weeks to get our appraiser over there to look at it, and then we'll decide what the loan will be. We cannot go to novices for an appraisal of value on things like that, and we certainly can't in our own lives. Can we look for an appraisal from the people that we work with and go to school with and to have our neighbors to see what we're worth? That's where so many of us draw an understanding of self-esteem. That's the biggest pressure in many cases when we're going through our teenage years. And I'm not so far removed from those years to be able to remember that. That we spend our lives as teenagers trying to figure out where we fit in and looking for approval from the people around us. And it sometimes is one of the biggest pressures that we have and a very severe danger that we face. If we get it from peers who don't know what we're worth, then we very well may come out with a warped understanding of our self-worth and self-value. The same thing can happen, and too often does, when we get an improper estimate of self-esteem from the family. We as parents and we as husbands have special responsibilities in the area of self-esteem, but not always do we fulfill them. I've got a responsibility to help my wife see where she fits in God's plan, and that means helping her to build self-esteem. I've got that responsibility toward my children to help them to understand not that they can do anything because they're somebody great. We're going to talk about the right basis for it. But to help them to understand that there are many things that they can accomplish and they need to reach out and do that. Some of you have been involved at different times in coaching athletics. How many times have you encouraged a young athlete to envision himself succeeding so that he then can succeed? Now, you're not going to guarantee him if he can see himself making the basket that every time he shoots, he's going to make it. If you could get a player like that, he'd have the state championship every year, right? But what you are going to try to do is convince him that he has the potential within him to accomplish something. When we put ourselves in God's perspective, we'll understand where that potential comes from, but we need to be able to see it. And it's our job in the family to help others recognize that. Others try to measure their self-esteem on the basis of success. We get out of the teenage years and we get out of the peer judgments to a degree, and we get into the career-oriented portions of our lives, and what we're worth is estimated on the basis of success. How much money does he make? How rapidly has he moved up the ladder in the particular business that he might be involved in? And too many people draw their estimates of self-worth on that basis, and what happens in a lot of cases is a man gets to be about 40, 45, 50 years old, hasn't moved to where some of his peers have, hasn't moved to where he had hoped to, and all of a sudden comes what they call a midlife crisis. I was listening to James Dobson on the radio a while back. He's a denominational teacher, and I acknowledge that. He does have some very valuable points on the home, and some of you have probably read some of his books. And he made the observation, described it not as a midlife crisis, but a midlife reevaluation, or reprioritization, if I can get that big word out there. That it's a time when men need to be reevaluating where they're going, rearranging priorities, determining what's really important in life. If we could be doing that back when we're teenagers, we could avoid a lot of the problems that come later in life by seeing where we belong in the first place. The only one who can appraise your value is God. And that's where we're going to spend the next few moments, is considering what God has to say to get that biblical perspective on self-esteem. What are we worth? What are you worth? And how do we find out? We already read 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20. The you were bought at a price. Acts chapter 20, verse 28 tells us the same thing. Oftentimes, we use this passage to deal with the concept of the value of the church, and we emphasize the idea of the church in an institutional sense. I'm afraid that that's probably missing the primary point that's there in verse 28. When he says, therefore take heed to yourselves and to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God which he purchased with his own blood. What did Jesus buy on the cross? He bought the souls of men and women. Those men and women collectively make up that flock which was to be overseen or watched for. What he's emphasizing here is the same thing that's in 1 Corinthians 6:20. You were bought at the price of the Son of God. That's what God thinks you are worth, that he was willing to pay such a high price to buy you. And if we can start from that basis and understand why, then we can accomplish a great deal more. We were created by God with a purpose in mind. In the 139th Psalm, David makes a statement in verse 14, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. He's dealing throughout this psalm with the concern that God had for him, and he praised him for the fact that he was fearfully and wonderfully made, this great creation that God had done. And we need to realize where we fit into that. You are the unique creation of God. Sometimes it's commented that there are no two snowflakes exactly alike, and it's the same thing for people. We might find some that look so much alike that it's frightening, but we know that they are different people, different personalities, different abilities, individuals in God's eyes. My wife likes to tell me sometimes that I'm a bit weird. I tell her the words unique, not weird. And that's what we need to recognize, that we are unique in God's eyes. He has made each of us as individuals. In fact, you can imagine how boring this world would be if we were all identical. I wouldn't want to think of a world like that. There's variety, and in the case of people, that is the spice of life. If we were all exactly the same, it wouldn't be a whole lot of a masterpiece as we look at this world. God has made a masterpiece, though. He has made you his unique creation. He wants you to be different than others. As Christians, he wants us to be different than the world. In Romans chapter 12, we'll turn to in just a moment. First, let's pick up a passage, though, in Matthew 5, where he says in verse 15, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Lights in the midst of darkness. You are unique and are to be different than the world around us. In Romans chapter 12, passage that I think is a very important one in understanding the role of self-esteem. He says in the opening verses, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you can present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Be different than the world. And then he goes on to say that God has a place that we fit in, and this is what we really need to understand. Verse 3, for I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. There's a balance there. And what I'm talking about when I speak of the problem of a poor self-esteem is not the opposite of arrogance. It's not to say that we ought to be haughty and arrogant and have the idea that we're better than everybody else. That's not a biblical concept. That is not the humility of the Bible. It is a confidence that we ought to have, though, in where we do fit in. And this passage does not stop with the fact that we are not to think more highly than we ought to think, but to think soberly. We've got to take seriously what we are, who we are, where we fit in. And the waste of a life, because we think we can't do anything of value, is not thinking soberly of ourselves. And the next few verses emphasize that very clearly. As God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually, members of one another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. Or ministry, let us use it in our ministry. He who teaches in teaching, he who exhorts in exhortation, he who gives with liberality, he who leads with diligence, he who shows mercy with cheerfulness. He says, look at what you can do. Look at who you are as the unique creation of God and use the gifts that he has given you for good. That's not something that is developed in a person who lives in a situation of low self-esteem. It's recognizing what God has done and what he has given us as a role in his plan. Not only are you the unique creation of God, you are the perfectly suited creation of God. I didn't say perfect, but perfectly suited. God has designed you to fit a place in his plan, to have a role in his creation. Consider back to the creation in Genesis 1 and 2, the position of man there. Given dominion over the world, made in the image of God, as a portrait, if you will, of God. And singled out above all the other things of creation to possess an immortal soul. God has suited us, each as individuals, to a particular place. He has made you someone special so that the question is not, as so often asked, who am I? But whose am I? Who made me? Who do I belong to? And if we will put ourselves in that perspective of a relationship to God, we then can recognize our own self-worth. A lack of self-esteem may cause us to feel inadequate and out of place in a lot of settings, like we just can't do things. And even, as I mentioned, it has its impact in our work as Christians, our service to God. How many times have we seen somebody else that was in error as far as the gospel was concerned and felt afraid to go and talk to them because we saw them as up here somewhere and we're down here? You imagine doing what the Apostle Paul did? Standing before the most powerful human being on the face of the earth and challenging him that he needed to make changes in his life. He eventually got to Caesar, as we understand from history and putting the pieces together from his appeal in Acts, and was willing to stand before him and testify of Jesus Christ. How many of us have ever considered approaching somebody of that kind of power? Or do we feel like, well, he wouldn't listen to me. I'm just way down here somewhere. If God wants us to be in heaven with him for eternity, what place on this earth is possibly out of our league? We've got to recognize the value that he has built into us and the position he's given us and the responsibility that goes with that and be servants for him. Not only are you the unique and the perfectly suited creation of God, but you are the continuing creation of God. Now, we can look at ourselves and say, well, I think this is about as complete as it gets. It's downhill from here. Well, in a physical sense, for most of us, that's true. I think that starts at about birth in one way, one sense of looking at it. But life is not something to be enjoyed and valued only by the young with the idea that as we get older, we're all washed off and it's done. Think about Moses. When was he called to do his most important work? At the age of 80. Think about Daniel. You've seen these pictures of this strapping young teenager being tossed in among the lions? Those were drawn by people who hadn't read the book. Daniel was somewhere around 80 or 90 years old when he was thrown in among the lions. God didn't give up on him just because he was aging a little bit. And we need to recognize that just because we're aging doesn't mean that God doesn't have something he can do with us. Simeon and Anna that we talked about the other night, aged servants of God, but they still had an important place. We need to recognize that God's still working on us. We've all seen the cartoons about the little child realizing that they've got a lot of growing to do. They're not as big as the people next door and such. Making the comment that, be patient with me, God isn't finished with me yet. As Christians, we need to recognize that that principle is very true. Philippians chapter 1 has an interesting statement that Paul makes in addressing this church that he loved so dearly. Being confident in verse 6, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. In our spiritual development, we are the continuing creation of God. And while I may see myself at this point thinking I can never do that, I've got to realize God's still working. God sees potential in each of us that we need to use. And if we allow ourselves to dismiss opportunities and responsibilities because we just don't think we're good enough, the consequence is that we will be ineffective servants of God. There's so many things that relate to the concept of self-esteem, and I've only touched an introduction in effect to it tonight, this morning. Yeah, I'm already off half the day. I lost 1 hour sleep, and I'm off by half the day. But there's so many things that relate to it. We have got to take the problem seriously, and we've got to consider how it affects in so many of the situations, in our own lives and as we deal with other people. And we've got to come back to a biblical basis and understand that God has given gifts of value to be used for each one of us. Let's use them. Let's not be taking something that God has designed for a tremendously valuable purpose and setting it on the shelf to where it's not used at all. God knew what he was doing, and we need to take advantage of the opportunities that he's given to us. You are God's creation for an important purpose in this life. Don't let anybody or anything or any pressure in life allow you to waste what God has done in you. But use it to his honor and glory so that he as well can rejoice with us for eternity. I appreciate your attention this morning and hope that some of the things here will at least get you started on some study of a very valuable topic for us.